We are talking today with Loretta Napoleoni, who is author of Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Networks. Loretta, thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Tell us, how is it that you wrote this current book?
I started researching this book 10 years ago. In the early 1990s, I was asked by the Red Brigades if I wanted to interview them. The Red Brigades was the Italian Marxist terrorist group, which was very active in the 1960s, 70s, and 1980s. They have never spoken with anybody. Part of their strategy to fight the Italian state was to have no communication whatsoever with it, including the defense lawyers at their trial. In the early 1990s, they decided that political conditions of Italy had changed so much that they could abandon the armed struggle. So they wanted to tell their story to somebody they trusted, and they approached me. The reason why they approached me is because I had been a founding member of the Italian feminist movement, and several female members of the Red Brigades had actually been part of this movement, so they knew me, although at the time I didn't know that they were members of the Red Brigades. But also my childhood friend, she was a leader of the Red Brigades, so I guess they trusted me on the personal level. On top of that, I was not a journalist, I was not to any political group. I was living abroad, so they felt I was not going to manipulate their story. While I was interviewing them, I discovered something unexpected. I discovered that their life was ruled by economics and not by politics. And this is when I developed the idea to research the economics of terrorism.
So what is your summation of the book? What's the reality of how money rules this?
Well, really, the underlying conclusion from my research is that in the last 50 years, armed organizations have been able to construct and develop an international economic system. And this international economic system today is $1.5 trillion, which is bigger than the GDP of the United Kingdom. Now, this is a system which is tapped into our system, into the Western economy, and is very much intertwined with traditional economy. And this has taken place basically in the last 50 years.
Can you give us some examples of perhaps how this built up? Are there specific terrorist groups that we could follow?
Well, I'll explain you how the evolution of this phenomenon took place first. Basically, I retrace the evolution of armed organization looking exclusively at their economics since the end of World War II. And I discovered that the first model was state-sponsored terrorism, which took place during the Cold War era. And this is when the West and the Soviet Union were fighting war by proxy along the periphery of the sphere of influence of, you know, the two blocks. This war by proxy were fought by armed organizations which were fully funded by the two blocks. So that's the beginning of what we define today modern terrorism. Then towards the late 1970s, there was a transition from this model to the model of privatization of terrorism. This is when armed organizations decided to find independent sources of revenues in order to break free from the political conditioning of the sponsors, but also to meet the increasingly high costs of running this organization. The best example of this transition is the PLO in the Middle East, the IRA, and ETA in Spain. Now, just to give you an example, the IRA was running all the private transportation in Northern Ireland. So every time you got into a taxi in Belfast, you were actually funding the IRA. So the interesting aspect of the privatization of terrorism is the fact that they were not only funding themselves through illegal activities, they were also funding themselves through legal activities. So the PLO was running a very large co-op called Samet. Samet was producing industrial products. It was active in the agricultural sector, but also in the movie industry. So most of the films that were produced in Lebanon in the 1970s were actually funded by the PLO, which is interesting. then the last stage of the evolution of this phenomenon is what I define the globalization of terrorism, and it took place in the 1990s during the deregulation, the economic deregulation which took place in the West. This is when armed organizations went transnational, so they were able to raise money in more than one country, but also they were able to operate in more than one country. And the model, I mean, the well-known model is Al-Qaeda.
So it sounds like they pretty much followed the U.S. capitalist model of private corporations.
Yeah, well, this is the amazing thing, is the fact that they are actually following an evolutionary trend which is really, really similar to ours. I mean, they're mirroring our system. And the reason why this is taking place is because they are tapped into our system. They are part of our system.
So obviously banks play a key role in all of this. Could you talk about that?
Yeah, banks are very important, and I think we have not looked at banks enough. Now, what the media has been saying since September 11 is that charities are the most important element of the so-called funding of this terror organization. The truth is the much more important role is played by banks, especially Islamic banks. Now, an armed organization is not run like a criminal organization. It's not like Cosa Nostra. See, criminal organization, what they really want is accumulate wealth. What an armed organization needs is not so much the accumulation of wealth as much as the distribution of this wealth. I mean, you have to send money from, you know, the source to the end user. And that, of course, often is quite difficult because we're talking about organizations which are transnational, so they operate all over the world. Now, the role of distribution of these funds is primarily done by banks, by Islamic banks. And then by the Hawala system, which is, you know, the system, the equivalent of our Western Union in Muslim countries, which is a fiduciary system where money are transferred from one country to another simultaneously, I mean, you know, on the spot, and is based on trust. So these are the two main channels that terrorists use. So the concept that terrorists carry suitcases full of cash, you know, from one country to another is actually not true at all.
So after September 11th, the U.S. began what they would call cracking down on potential terrorist connections here locally. They focused on some of the families that were using like Western Union type operations to transfer money overseas. Do you think that was a realistic thing to target, or were they just shooting at smaller fish there?
I think they were shooting at smaller fish. In fact, all the West has done so far is very little. There was freezing of charity funds. There was freezing of some of these exchanges used by armed organization to transfer money, but it was really very little, and it lasted only for a few months. I mean, the real problem is the fact that we have no access to the transmission belt of most of this money in the Middle East and in the Muslim countries, because the Islamic banking system is completely independent from our system. I mean, it's not part of the international banking system, so they do not come under the same monetary authorities that we do. They do business with traditional banks, with Western banks, but it's very limited. If you look at the pattern of the distribution of funds, the pattern takes place primarily in Muslim countries. I mean, the center is Saudi Arabia, as you know, we actually know. And then from Saudi Arabia, various Islamic groups are funded within the Muslim world. So it's completely outside our system. I mean, how to go about is a big problem, because we have to rely upon you know, a third party. We have to rely upon the various governments of the Muslim countries, and that's a problem.
I want to get back to Saudi Arabia, but I want to ask you a couple more questions about the U.S. banking system, or the Western banking system, because it doesn't really seem that, although there are structures in place for looking into how money moves about, it doesn't seem like there are many examples up till today where they've actually done that. I mean, if you look at like the BCCI scandal and all the different drug trade, they never cracked down on the banks here locally.
No, they don't. And I'll tell you something else, which is even more serious, is the majority of this $1.5 trillion has to be money laundered somewhere. And actually, it's money laundered inside the United States and partly in Europe. And the primary source of money laundering is actually the U.S. banks. I mean, there is a legislation in place in this country whereby deposits over $10,000 have to be reported, but the truth is that very little is reported. The Treasury Department has admitted recently that about 99% of the money which entered this country illegally for, you know, the reason of money laundering actually gets through the system. So it's very difficult to block it, because that would mean to increase the controls on the banking system, which is something that, of course, banks do not want. I mean, we went through 10 years of deregularization. How are we going to go back to the past? It's almost impossible.
And as I've heard from, again, in the banking industry here in the West, the banks are fully well aware of this money coming through them and obviously are making great profits off it. So they would seem to be colluding then with both the criminals as well as the terrorists.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, if you think about $1.5 trillion that enters the Western economy, primarily in the U.S., again, and partly Europe, on a yearly basis, it's an amazing injection of cash. Now, if we cut this overnight, we'll go into a deep recession. So, I mean, we are dependent upon this economy also for our own economy. And this is the most important aspect of the problem is, you know, how do we disassociate ourselves from their system without ending up hurting ourselves?
Do you have an answer to that question? That seems like a tough one.
Well, I think, you know, the only way to go about is, first of all, starting a long-term process. Now, this is not something that can be solved in the space of one U.S. administration. I mean, we're talking about a decade of work to be done. There are economic instruments which we can use in order to reduce this flow of illegal and terror money coming into our economy, and we can do it gradually so we can actually wean ourselves out of this addiction, because it is like to be addicted to drugs, basically. But the third element, which is the most important element, is we got to change our foreign policy. And that's the key question, is actually understanding why Islamic terror is taking place. I mean, what are the real reasons behind this insurgency taking place in the Muslim world, and also which are the real targets. Now, if we identify that, then we can work on the actual source of the problem. But this will take a drastic change in our foreign policy.
Talk a bit about Saudi Arabia. You brought them up before. According to news accounts, supposedly 15 of the 19 terrorists that did the hijacking were from Saudi Arabia, yet this country has a long history of being very close with Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia is an extremely interesting phenomenon, and it is very much indicative of what is really taking place. Now, the reason why the U.S. has a very special relationship with Saudi Arabia is not only oil. I mean, oil is an important issue, absolutely. But there is also another element, which is the role that Saudi Arabia has played in the Middle East since 1978, since the Iranian Revolution. And if we look at the U.S. foreign policy, this is the moment in which the relationship really starts taking shape between the various U.S. administration and the Saudis. The Saudis were given the task to contain and contrast the expansionary waves coming from the Islamic Republic of Iran, because Iran is perceived still today by the U.S. as, you know, the most important enemy and opposition force towards, you know, the U.S. So there is that element which we have also to bear in mind. Now, this is why the U.S. has systematically backed a regime which is breaking every single human rights on a daily basis, a regime that is oppressing its own people, that is highly undemocratic, which is to a certain extent a contradiction in terms. Now, the role of Saudi Arabia in the financing of terrorism is very important, because what I discovered in my research is that religion is very much an umbrella under which a very important alliance has been forged. And this alliance is between the emerging middle class of Saudi Arabia and the radical clerics. Now, the middle class has taken shape in the late 70s from the first flows of money generated by the first oil shock, and he has consolidated its power and position through the 1980s. At the beginning of the 1990s, the middle class start running against economic roadblocks. Now, these economic roadblocks were put in place by the existing regime, which is not economically democratic, but it is an oligarchic regime. It's a corrupted oligarchy regime. And also the problems related to these roadblocks were linked to the interest of Western corporations in these regions, which of course were backed by the existing regime. So the combination of these two blocked the further development of this middle class. Therefore, this middle class decided to push for a regime change. The alliance with the clerics came because also the radical clerics wanted a regime change in Saudi Arabia. Now, let's not forget that the House of Saud is based upon the alliance with the radical clerics. So the role of the House of Saud is to promote Wahhabism, which is the most radical interpretation of Islam, not only inside Saudi Arabia, but in the rest of the world. So, I mean, they proselytize the Wahhabism. Now, the radical clerics were becoming increasingly dissatisfied with the Western style of life of the House of Saud, but also with the clear links with Western companies, the corruption that was taking place inside Saudi Arabia because of Western interests. So this alliance was forged in order to push for a regime change. Because the Islamic clerics were linked to Islamic terror, and this is primarily took place during the 1980s, the anti-Soviet jihad, the Saudi middle class ended up financing the Islamic terrorist groups across the world. And religion was used as a recruitment tool to get the masses, the dissatisfied masses across the Middle East, to join in this insurgency. So that's, you know, the essence of what is taking place. And the interesting element is that religion is only a sort of recruitment tool, almost, you know, a cover-up. The real forces are actually economic forces who are putting pressure for regime changes.
So the radical Muslim religious leaders, their relationship to the middle class, the religious leaders that were backing that early on, are those two separate groups of religious leaders?
No, it's the same group of religious leaders. It's called the ulama. In fact, the ambiguity of the ulama is particularly enlightening. I mean, on one hand, the ulama is still backing the House of Saud because, of course, you know, this is how the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia was built. But at the same time, the ulama is protecting Osama bin Laden and, you know, the various Islamic groups. So they're almost betting on the two horses, making sure that, you know, they will come on top of it, which is very much the style of Middle Eastern policy, business, and way of life. But the truth is that the involvement of the radical clerics within the economic system of Islam is very much a reality. Islamic banks were formed in the late 1970s by a group of visionary bankers from Saudi Arabia. They provided the funds, but the actual structure of the bank was laid down by the clerics and the Islamic scholars. So Islamic banks incorporate inside their structure the principle of the Sharia law. So the zakat, for example, which is, you know, the religious almsgiving that every single Muslim has to pay every year, equivalent to 2.5% of the wealth, is incorporated in the Islamic bank. So every single transaction that takes place, 2.5% is levied and taken out for the zakat. So this is quite important, because that also shows you the link between the funding, the charitable funding of this organization, and the role of the banks.
The radical clerics, they have significant influence over the banking system itself?
Yes, the radical clerics have significant importance within the banking system. In fact, you know, some of them are actually part of the board of directors of these banks, because they participate in the creation of these banks. So the religious element is there in place, and has been translated into the economics of Islam. And the truth is that if you go back to the history of Islam, to the origins of Islam, the economic elements was always there. You know, Muhammad was a trader. So there is a tradition in the Sharia law which is related to the economics, and what they're doing is, you know, bring back that tradition and just put it in place in today's world, creating Islamic banks.
And my understanding was the Wahhabism and the radical clerics were the ones that instituted, for instance, the schools that were in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region that the Taliban later came out of.
Yes, those are the madrasas, the religious schools. What has happened is this middle class in the 1980s start participating in the funding of the Mujahideen. Now, the anti-Soviet jihad, which took place in Afghanistan in the 1980s against the Soviet, was primarily financed by the CIA and the Saudis. This was a $5 billion per year financing, which was not enough to keep the Mujahideen going, partly also because through the pipeline the money were taken out by various bribes and people that actually stolen the money. So the idea came to get some private financing directly from people in the Middle East, in particular Saudi Arabia. And this is when the clerics organized this funding through charities from Saudi Arabia. This money went to help the Mujahideen to buy arms and food, but also they went to construct a mosque and madrasas around the Muslim world in order to export the concept of Wahhabist Islam. This took place primarily right after the end of the anti-Soviet jihad, when the Soviet Union collapsed, and some regions of the Soviet Union where there was a majority of Muslim were targeted by this group of people, in particular it's the Central Asian republics, the Caucasus, and Bosnia, Albania. So what the idea was to export Wahhabism and turn this country into Islamic states, and then, you know, use the banks to help them financially to get on their feet, and then start trading with this country. So colonizing, basically, economically and religiously, these countries.
It would seem to be a good combination.
Yes, it was a very successful combination. Albania is actually the best example. After the fall of the pyramid scheme in the mid to late 1990s, the Islamic banks, both from Iran and from Saudi Arabia, moved in and basically replaced the existing economy with their own economy. The same thing they did in Egypt. They moved into Egypt in the 1990s, and they made deals in order to be able to supply ready cash at very advantageous rates, because of course Islamic banks do not charge interest rate, and in exchange for that they got a free ride to proselytize Wahhabism inside Egypt.
Now, prior to the enormous influx of money from Saudi Arabia in the 70s to create the Islamic banks, there must have been some structure of Islamic banks then. Was this like so much money that came in that just took over that?
There was not a banking system as such. Now, let's not forget that Saudi Arabia, before the first oil shock, was not a wealthy country at all. It was a country based on agricultural Bedouin. It was a Bedouin society, so people were nomads moving, you know, from one place to another. There was not real economic infrastructure. In the Middle East, before the arrival and creation of Islamic banks, the only banks available were actually Western banks. Now, not necessarily in Saudi Arabia, but Egypt, for example, is a good example. Jordan, countries that were more developed than Saudi Arabia before, you know, of course, the 1970s. There was a lot of resentment within the population towards these banks because, you know, they proposed the Western style economic system whereby you charge interest rate. And this is against the Islamic religion. You're not meant to lend money, you know, for money.
Now, the House of Saud in Saudi Arabia must realize, like you do, that this power shift is occurring with all this money and tied into the religion there. If that continues, they lose power. What are they doing to try and counter that?
Well, this is the roots, I think, of the ambiguity of the House of Saud towards this phenomenon. Because, first of all, there are even members of the royal family who are backing this Islamic insurgency. There are members of the royal family which are supporting bin Laden, and also that they're clearly anti-Western from the religious point of view, whereby, you know, they think that Christians and Jews are, you know, inferior human beings because they're not Islamic. So there is this element. But then at the same time, there is also the role that Saudi Arabia has played within the Western foreign policy since 1978. And, you know, there is the desire to continue to please the U.S. And the Western allies because, you know, without the backing, the military backing of the U.S. In particular, the House of Saud probably will not survive. So that's part of the ambiguity. And I see that they are trying to please both parties, but the truth is that they can't do this. There'll be a point in which something will definitely happen in Saudi Arabia. Also because the population is very dissatisfied with the existing rulers. There was a classified opinion poll which was conducted at the beginning of the summer in Saudi Arabia, and it was publicized by a group of dissidents in London, Saudi dissidents, and apparently the results were shocking because the poll was conducted among population aged 25 to 45, and 95% of the population is actually backing Osama bin Laden.
Within your entire study of putting this book together, obviously you come up with a lot of revelations in it, but what do you really see as the most important ideas that came out in your work?
Well, I think, you know, the most important discovery of my book is the fact that what we're witnessing is like the Christian Crusade, but in the reversal order. See, the Christian Crusades were launched by the West, where at that time was a colony of Islam. Religion was the umbrella under which a very important alliance was forged between the emerging middle class of Western Europe, bankers and traders and merchants who wanted to break away from the economic hegemony of Islam, and the religion classes, you know, the Christians, who actually granted the legitimacy to the Crusades. So the idea to liberate Jerusalem from the Arabs, to free the Christian, was actually the recruiting tool. The real reason was that there were city-states like Venice who were putting a lot of pressure in order to trade directly with the Far East without going via, you know, the various intermediaries from the Arab countries. So it was an economic expansionary process that was taking place in Europe, which created the Crusades. And we're witnessing the same thing today in the Middle East and Muslim world. I mean, they want to break away from the economic conditioning created by the West, who has been backing oligarchy corrupted regimes since the end of World War II. The real target is not the West, because the West is not exercising directly an hegemonic power as it was during the colonization period. The real goal is to remove the existing oligarchic elites who are clearly oppressing the people. And the reason why they're coming after us is because we are perceived as the backers of these regimes. So that was the most interesting discovery, because that shows that really that they're not coming after the people of the West, and they don't want to kill Americans necessarily, or, you know, Europeans. All they want is to have a free hand in their own country in order to bring a different society.
We have been talking today with Loretta Napoleoni, who has just written the new book, Modern Jihad, Tracing the Dollars Behind the Terror Network. Loretta, thank you for sharing time with us today.
Well, thank you very much.